is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my ever-genial co-host, Eagle One of Eagle Speak. For those that are joining us live, just want to make sure and remind you, go ahead and scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you'll find a place to join in with the chat room. We got a lot of the usual suspects there. If you have some observations during the course of the show, that's a great place to share it. Even better, if there's a question that you would like for us to address to our guest that you don't think we're quite going to get to, if you want to go ahead and put that in there, we'll be monitoring it during the course of the show, and we're more than happy to steal other people's questions if they're better than ours. And for those that are new to the show, if you want to catch up on previous episodes, the full archive is always over there at Blog Talk Radio. And also, if you have to leave halfway through the show and you want to know what you missed, you can always go back, grab the full show at the archive. And that's also a place where when you're with us live at the one-hour mark, the audio will go dead, the show will end, but it keeps recording afterwards. So if it cuts off in mid-conversation, the reason is maybe there's one more question we want to ask our guest, or our guest is in the course of answering a question, and we don't want to rush them. So there might be a few minutes of the show that keeps going afterwards. Often that's the really good tie-up, so make sure and go back and grab that so you get the full show. And now let's get on with the show. One thing we want to cover today is we want to look back, for those who have been around the business for a while, we've gone through these cycles before. But here in 2014, for over a decade, we've been engaged in combat operations, mostly ashore. Iraq winded down a few years ago. This summer, our maneuver forces will be out of Afghanistan. And we have rolled into that a different economic and budgetary environment that is putting some stresses not just on defense spending, but our ability to meet our national commitments. At the same time, we're going through a strategic realignment and a generational change, not just in leadership, but in the seed corn for our future leadership, and that is our junior officers. And what we want to look at is some of the indications we have on the direction we're going on our ability to retain those people. We're going to look at what challenges we may be looking at, whether they're institutional or generational, what steps can be made in the short term to address it, what longer-term policies may need to be put into place or perhaps even eliminated in order to address what might be a systemic issue. And we also want to know, as we always see in moments of challenge and stress, there's also opportunities embedded in there to come out the other end in a much better position than you had going in. And we've got a great couple of guests for the full hour. We have Vice Admiral Bill Moran. He is the Chief of Naval Personnel, and also Commander Guy Buss Snodgrass, the prospective executive officer working through the pre-command pipeline en route to his command tour over in Atsugi, Japan, with Strike Fighter Squadron 195. Gentlemen, welcome to Midrats.
Thanks, Sal. It's good to be here.
Sal, Bill Moran. Good to be here. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome, and really do appreciate y'all taking time today to talk about a paper that really has received a lot of attention. And, Buss, I thought you did a really great job rolling it up. And I wanted to address the first question to Vice Admiral Moran is, as a Chief of Naval Personnel, I think one thing that's really commendable is you've been, and coming on Midrats is just another demonstration of that, you've been very out front in what has been a very public discussion of a pretty clear-eyed and direct summary of some of the issues that we have in officer retention, not just a lot of it does focus on post-command commanders, but it also feeds into our junior officers as well. And what I'm curious about is kind of a theme setter of where we are, is what brought you to the decision point that you said, okay, this needs a lot of light, a lot of air, let's talk about it, let's get this out there, see what the reaction is. And has this process worked out generally as you hoped it would?
Yes, Sal, I never really got to a deciding point. It got out there in the blogs, and it's received a lot of attention for all the reasons you stated. The decision was made for me, although, you know, when Buss and I talked about this a couple months ago down at an aviation commander's course down in Pensacola, the discussion then was, hey, we all see the challenges coming. And there were a lot of good ideas that were coming from that cohort of folks that were down there with Buss. And I said, hey, send me an email. Shoot me a paper. Do something that gives us some thoughts and ideas up here, because you were bringing up some great points. And little did I know that Buss would take me up on that in a big way and write a 26-page paper with some terrific ideas, articulated well. And it started the debate online, and it started a debate inside of Navy at the senior-most levels to include myself and CNO and other in the fleet commander. So no decision for me. It just got out there, and I think it's terrific that we're able to have this opportunity to talk about it. Buss, over to you. I think you might have a perspective on that.
Yes, sir. Thank you. And, Sal, thanks again for the opportunity to come and be on your show. One thing I thought I might do, if you'd indulge me maybe 2-3 minutes, is just maybe provide just a quick perspective on what even led up to the paper, because if your listeners are either new to the discussion or aren't aware of all the ins and outs of the paper, this might help clear it up for them. But, so really real quick, who I am, Naval Strike Fighter, incredibly pleased with my career. I'm a company man. And so I think that might raise people's eyebrows. Then why in the world are you writing about retention and starting to ring alarm bells before we're really kind of seeing some stuff come out? And essentially that kind of gets to why I wrote the paper. I was seeing during my time in the Pentagon, which is where I left back in October, starting to see a widening gap kind of created between what senior leaders seem to be getting as far as information flow, which would allow them to make retention-based decisions, and then, of course, what men and women on the deck plate were discussing openly and talking about. And there seemed to be this looming retention crisis that was kind of going unobserved. So I took a look at basically what they've been saying for a few years, collected a lot of information, came up with some factors, and I knew that if it was going to catch any traction at all, and just like Vice Admiral Moran said, that's absolutely right. He came to our command leadership school class up in Newport, talked to us there. He also talked to us down at Pensacola during our aviation commanding officer training course. And he did throw it out there. He said, if you've got something, let me know. And from my time in the Pentagon, it seemed like, well, there's really only one or two ways you're going to grab someone's attention. It's going to have to be underpinned by facts. You're going to have to provide a compelling narrative to kind of spell it all out. And you also need to come with solutions, not just with problems. So doing all the research, kind of looking into some organizational philosophy, taking a look at maybe what some of the corporate approaches have been, and I thought that was very insightful because a lot of times it's very easy to fall back on, well, pay more money or provide additional financial incentives. And a lot of the corporate approaches and a lot of the research that some of these think tanks have concluded with is that there are always price points you're never going to be able to meet. So there's all these intangibles that maybe we can get after, and that's what led to the 14 recommendations you see in the paper. Was the desire to get to those intangibles or get to some things that weren't necessarily directly tied to money. Now, of course, the bonus is one that is, but a lot of the other ones are more intangible that kind of get to the quality of work or quality of life of the men and women who are in the Navy. Since the paper was sent to Vice Admiral Moran, as he mentioned, it kind of floated out into the ether and went viral after that. And I think that's kind of a unique thing. The response to this paper has been certainly more than I ever expected to see, and I think probably more than anybody would have expected to see. And so that kind of got me thinking. I'd studied some previous cycles of retention previously to see what makes this time different than the 70s or the 80s or even the downturn in the 90s. And I came up with just a few, and this is just kind of to set the scene maybe for some follow-on questions, but one of the things that kind of makes this time different is that the paper is, I would consider, to be more on the leading edge. In years past, you look at previous cycles, usually people are starting to write about it once you see a mass exodus. And I believe the factors have all lined up that that's where we're headed, although we're just now starting to see the very beginnings of it. The second thing, I think a lot of people in the fleet would definitely concur with the fact that we're seeing a significant decrease in the resources that are being provided to us, but we're not seeing the corresponding decrease in demand like you did back following the Vietnam War or following the Gulf War. So there's still a significant demand on our men and women and on our materiel, but not matching up with the decline in resources. And I think one of the biggest ones is going to be the advent of social media. That's something that is relatively new compared to the cycle from the 90s. We kind of skipped the downturn in the 2000s because of post-9/11 sentiment and people going to conflict because of it. So we kind of skipped that one. But prior cycles didn't necessarily have the viral aspect of social media. And so what's happened so far, a lot of widespread acclaim for just the paper itself. I think ventilating this topic has been good. And it's been nice, just like Vice Admiral Moran mentioned, it's been very nice to see such quick engagement, because I think, I don't know if it necessarily signifies that they agree that there's a problem, but certainly that they're concerned about the welfare of the men and women serving with us. So I think one of the JOs who wrote to me kind of put it best. He said, and I quote, "The canary has sung, will anything be done?" And so I think that will be interesting to see as we move forward.
Admiral, this is Eagle One. Was there a surprise in the response to this paper that totally shocked you in any way, or is this kind of something you would have expected based on your experience and history in the fleet?
Yeah, Eagle One, I wasn't shocked by anything other than the fact that people were willing to come out and express their views as in the numbers that have come forward. You know, Buzz just mentioned the canary. I think that canary sang a long time ago, and we have been talking about many of the signs and signals that we were going to enter into a retention problem several months ago, even a year ago. I think most of us were sitting around trying to figure out how we were going to anticipate coming off enormously high retention across every aspect of the fleet for the last 10 years, frankly. And knowing very well that post-war, you're likely going to see a decline in budget, you're likely going to see a decline in people's desire to want to serve, and so what are we going to do about that? So we've been having an ongoing conversation, but quite frankly, it's been all in Washington, D.C., for me anyways, and I was very anxious to want to get information and lines of bearing crossing, if you will, from young officers and enlisted in the fleet. And so I, quite frankly, surprised at the response, yes, in terms of quantity, but very pleased to see it happening, because I'm getting a lot of lines of bearing crossing on the things we're already doing that make sense, that we should continue with, and then several things in this paper that Buss raised that we hadn't considered that we are now considering, and I think it's a good, healthy discussion to have at our level.
Hey, Buss, a question I wanted to direct your way, and obviously this, and I think identifying the background at which was the genesis of this paper, I think helps people understand one of the big focus points of your paper, and something you're closest to, are the feelings of those in the PCO pipeline, and because of your peer group, also those that are coming off and leaving command. And one of the concerns that you have, and that you outline very well in the paper, is your post-commander command guys are they're punching out. They have doing that cost-benefit analysis. They're not even through with their command tour, and they're looking at getting out at first opportunity. Is that, besides the practical implications of that I know Admiral Moran can talk about, downstream when we have that cohort of leadership leave, what that second and third order effect is, but a little closer to home, Buss, what type of indication and warning does that demonstrate to everybody to be concerned? And what is different about this cohort going through that is maybe changing their decision matrix that we may have seen before?
Well, it's interesting you ask, and I know people have been kind of asking that same question. What makes this cycle different? And it's funny because, as you notice with the factors, you see stuff like too much family separation, unable to sufficiently plan and control your career, or the insufficient managerial or leadership qualities of seniors. And it's funny because as I read this, I'm actually reading this off of a March 1986 report that was produced for Admiral Watkins, who was then CEO from the Naval Medical Research and Development Command. So a lot of times when people say, well, what makes this cycle different? In many ways, I think it's similar to the past cycles. And that gets back to the main theme of the paper, which is, well, if it's cyclical, if we tend to see this kind of retention concern following a downturn, which is where we are on the leading edges of right now, we have every indication to believe that an exodus of some sort is likely to follow. So specifically to your question about commanding officers leaving post-command, and a little bit of a misnomer in the paper, what I really meant to say was that these are commanding officers who leave prior to selection for captain. So many are leaving immediately following their command tour, especially if they're within that 19 to 20-year window. Some are leaving shortly thereafter, but before they or right after they hit the 20-year window. But I think that's telling because it's going to be matched up with a increased exodus of our junior officers who are hitting their minimum service requirement window. So their first opportunity on whether to stay in or whether to get out, they're looking up the chain like we all did when we were junior officers, and they're trying to just kind of read the tea leaves. What would my future look like? And if I look at my department head, I look at my commanding officer, maybe even beyond, what do I see? And if you see some of your department heads leaving, which we are right now, we've seen quite a few who were selected, who were selected for 04 for lieutenant commander, and were subsequently selected for their department head tour, at least in naval aviation, and then subsequently turned it down. So they're leaving. And then when you look at your commanding officer, who, whether implicitly or explicitly, signals that he's leaving while he's in command, I think that sends a very strong signal. And so the concern would be that not only is it maybe just an exodus of your post-command commanders hitting that 20-year mark, kind of getting to the end or to the finish line for a 20-year retirement, it's the officers who are below them as well. And as the paper kind of lined out, that's the pool of officers. That's the only pool you're going to have as they continue to move forward. It's not going to continue to grow. You can't directly assess at the mid-career or senior officer point. You have to accept what you have when you assess them at the beginning. And so that large, widespread exodus across all rank levels is what concerns me.
Well, when you, Eagle One again, when you were on Sailor Bob, looking at the responses that so many SWOs were putting out there, were there surprises for you in the reactions to your paper and in the way people looked at what you had to say?
I'm sorry, is that directed to me?
Yeah, I'm sorry, Bus.
Okay. I will tell you, as someone who had recently gone through the War College and as someone who had previously published for something like the Naval Strike and Air Warfare Center Journal, you realize that you're never going to publish anything and have everybody just give you a thumbs up. You're always going to hear typically a significant portion of your readership or somebody's going to come back and say, okay, hey, you wrote this, but, man, I disagree wholeheartedly with your thesis. I think it was, you missed the markets over here. And I think that's healthy. And that was quite frankly, once I knew this had escaped the sanctity of the personnel command and the N1 lifelines, I fully expected that to happen. And I was absolutely floored that here we are roughly 2 weeks after it started making the rounds, and that has not occurred. I've saved every email, text, et cetera, that I've received, and just to kind of be able to look through them. And what you find is, I mean, greater than a 95% thumbs up. And that's from 2 stars on down to enlisted members. So 2 things. One is the widespread, the echoing sentiment of you have captured well what we believe are the significant factors. And I think that's noteworthy for senior leadership because I think it does exactly what the paper was intended to do. It gives them a little bit of a glimpse or some insight into what men and women at the deck plate are thinking. I think the second big surprise is that it started kind of spreading out through naval aviation. It jumped through every community. I've heard from everybody from JAG Corps, Civil Engineering Corps, and they all feel the same way about it. And then just this past Thursday, I started receiving emails from enlisted members. So they're now getting it through social media and through Facebook. And a lot of them have said along the lines of, wow, you captured exactly what we're thinking. Now, when's someone going to write the paper for us to talk about recommendations on their behalf? So that, to me, quite frankly, was surprising. I expected a lot more pushback or a lot more suggestions I received.
Vice Admiral Moran, there's an Australian entrepreneur who specializes in recruitment and headhunting out there, bought and sold a few companies. He writes a lot online. He does the little speaking tour. Greg Savage, he's popularized something you hear a lot in the civilian world when it comes to retaining your best people and trying to recruit people from other companies that you need to fill a niche. And the phrase is, people don't leave companies, they leave leaders. Sometimes this phrase, people don't leave companies, they leave management. And you've talked about how this paper has been brought on board and discussed up at senior leadership. And some of the things that developed in the paper, you can go back to October 1998. There was an article in Proceedings called Listen to the JOs, Why Retention is a Problem. Not all these themes are radically new, but has there been a discussion and a little bit of self-reflection at the senior leadership level about, hey, if these people are leaving in this many droves, as opposed to looking at whether it's a money issue, a bonus issue, or a adjusting career path issue, what are we as senior leaders doing or not doing that might be able to contribute or mitigate this problem that we see of our intellectual capital leaving?
Yeah, it's a great question, Sal. When I first got in the job and had conversations around the fleet with people, it became pretty clear to me that COs widely felt that their authorities and responsibility and to some extent the accountability piece had been stripped from them. At least that's their perception, and perception can become reality. So I undertook several things back here in the Bureau to start having a conversation with my leadership team about what are some policies, what are some mechanics that we can put in place that strengthen a CO's role even more than it is today. And I think you're going to get there are a lot of opinions about how to do that, but I look at things like how we assess and advance enlisted sailors as a one example of the things that we're looking at to change the advancement system such that COs get a greater vote, a greater voice in the young men and women who get to advance to the next rate, those who get to advance to chief petty officer, those who are capped. All of those processes out in the fleet that I believe the COs are the ones who know their people the best and should have the greatest voice in making sure good young men and women stay. To go back to the discussion you just had about the post-command commanders, there's definitely a spike in the trend in the wrong direction that has been coming on now for a few quarters, and that's some of that structural, in that our promotion zones and promotion opportunities have slipped further and further right over time, which pushes commanders, COs at the O5 level, into assuming command and later than I experienced 15 years ago. And so when they're done with their command tour, they're right in the 19 and 19 and a half year mark. And so they're left with a fairly black and white choice about whether to stay in or get out at the 20 year mark. So they didn't have to take – some of them do not have to take orders in order to retire. And I think that's something that policy-wise and mechanically we can do back in the Bureau to change that, to change the calculus and perhaps – see more people stick around after their command tour. So this is about keeping quality people, whether you're talking about officers or you're talking about enlisted. And even though the sense you're getting from the blogs is that we're seeing people leave in droves, that's not necessarily true. We're seeing areas, small areas, where the indications are starting to show that we may have a problem on our the horizon. And that's what Buss has been focused on here, and I think he's absolutely right that we can't afford to miss this. I often talk about swinging behind the pitch, and that was what I experienced when I was a placement officer in the Bureau back in the mid-90s, and saw it as a department head, saw it as an XO and CO, that oftentimes our policies missed an opportunity, and by the time they got in place, we'd already had an exodus of great talent, both on the enlisted side and the officer side. And so the hair's up on the back of my neck right now as I watch some of these leading indicators, and I want to make sure that we have enough conversation between those who are serving in the fleet and those at my level who are trying to execute policy, that the policies get out there in time to be able to hit this pitch, whatever it might be. So that's a long-winded answer to your question, but it is front and center of the conversations we're having in my own organization right now.
Well, Admiral, since you're in the personnel side of the house, how much impact do you perceive the other forces in the Navy have on retention? I mean, you can put the right person in the right job, but if that job turns out to be one where some operational commander is doing something that causes that person to be driven nuts and decides that the lifestyle is not what he wants anymore, do you have any say in that, or is that just the kind of the luck of the draw for that individual?
I don't have much of a say in it in terms of who goes where, if that's your question. I do think that this past year was a harbinger for the difficulty we see coming in the future. And when you look at FY or calendar year 13, especially, tough year across DOD with sequestration kicking in, with government shutdown, with furloughs, with having to delay deployments, cancel deployments, bringing some air wings back to tactical hard deck after deployment because we did not have the right colors of money to be able to put in to operations and training. Those things hurt probably morale more than anything else. And everybody in leadership position understood that. And so we tried to scrape together money, different colors of money and authorities that were available to us to spread that and try to buy back some of that training and readiness and some of those operations. And it worked, but frankly, in the future, if we don't resolve the sequestration part of the budget, we've run out of options in many cases. And on the personnel front, there's nowhere to go if we have continued issues with the sequestration law as it's written. So we've got a bit of a reprieve the rest of this year. 15, it'll kind of kick back in, and then 16 is we're right back where we were last year, unless Congress acts and we are able to have a budget from the beginning of the fiscal year. So there's a lot going in there, and I'm not sure I answered your original question other than to say that you're absolutely right in terms of the things that influence and affect people's morale, especially in command, are the things that we did last year out of necessity to try to balance the books, and we didn't have the money, the colors of money in the right places to be able to make up for that. And so if I didn't answer your question, please rephrase it, and I'll try.
I think you did fine. I think that probably the question is awkward because the needs of the service sometimes are not the same needs that you see in the personnel system, and buses, is that part of the argument you make, is that we're not necessarily as bound together, the personnel side and the operational side, as we should be?
Well, I'm not sure that's the argument to be made. I definitely would like to take a quick step back, not to the most recent, but the previous question. I think Vice Admiral Moran brought up a couple things that are important to note. One of the things he mentioned is that in the blogosphere or on messaging boards, discussion boards, there have been some people talking about people leaving in droves, and I agree with them. I don't think they are yet. And that was the whole purpose behind the paper, was to try and get out in front of this bow wave to say, here is information that we can act on now, vice producing the same paper 2 years from now, and everybody looks at it and says, well, thank you very much for telling us what we already know. another thing that I think is interesting, because Vice Admiral Moran talked about empowering commanding officers to be able to help incentivize their men and women remaining in uniform, and I do agree with that. I think that one of the things that should be noted in this conversation explicitly is that it's way too easy sometimes for all of us, anybody 06 and below, to complain about a problem, point uphill, and say it's those guys. They're the ones who are making life hard for us. And that's not the case. I think we all know it. I mean, there's certainly an aspect of leadership or of ownership for the service, ownership for the U.S. Navy that applies to all of us, because the truth is, if you remain in uniform, this is the service that you will one day be inheriting as you continue to move up through the ranks. One of the things that I think, back to the whole whether or not people are leaving in droves, I think we are beginning to see a little bit of that precipice. In fact, as we kind of look forward to some of the upcoming selection boards, we already know that if you look at PERS 43, which is Naval Aviation, we anticipate being five short the number of department heads that we can make. So in this case, if we need to select 45 aviation department heads for the strike fighter community, we're only anticipating having 40 eligible men and women to fill those slots. And the same is true for the VAQ community, which is the Prowler or Growler community, where we need to have somewhere on the order of about 14 VAQ department heads created, but you only have five bodies. So you're short nine people. And I think that's where you're going to start to see a real compounding of this problem, is because for the last 8 to 10 years, we slowly started to underassess to try and control costs, to try and become more efficient. But now as you see retention start to decrease, you're going to be squeezing us from both ends, and that's probably a significant source of concern. I think we're about the halfway point of the show, and one thing I would like to do is just take a quick step back and kind of open up the aperture, and that is when you think about all this stuff, I mean, yes, is it the deck plate? Is it leadership? I mean, who is responsible for making these moves? I think everybody would be well served to take a look. There's a book out there called Exit, Voice, and Loyalty. And it was written by an economist named Albert Hirschman. And it was published actually way back in 1970 by the Harvard University Press. But what it does is it takes a look at exactly what we're facing now and what we have faced in previous retention cycles. And he kind of breaks down any organization, of course, which the United States Navy is a large one, and says, well, there are always going to be these repairable lapses, things that occur that you can fix, and this is one of those. Retention problems are a repairable fix. But the only way you can do that is through finding the right balance of getting the information flow that you need to make smart decisions, incentivizing retention, and that could be monetary or non-monetary, and then being very flexible with your response. And I think that's kind of where we found difficulty in the last few cycles, is that we're certainly not necessarily flexible in our response, and we tend to be, as Admiral Moran has said previously, we kind of sometimes swing behind the pitch. So what you're seeing now is exactly what he draws out in this book. It's you have two large groups of people. You have those who are going to vote with their feet and they're going to leave, and then you have others, and I'd like to think that I'm part of this group, which are the voices. They're the ones who speak out and say, this is a problem. This is something that needs to be fixed. What really makes a difference between those two groups, according to Albert Hirschman, is loyalty. And I think that's a key factor that may be worth discussing, and that is that, well, what keeps somebody in? A large part of his research would show that no matter what the organization is, it's loyalty to that organization. And so I fear, much like the factors in the paper, that when the men and women wearing the uniform hear about upcoming reductions in their COLA, upcoming reductions in VAH, upcoming challenges to the 20-year retirement system, a lot of these instances, along with some of the administrative distractions, start to kind of erode or chip away at that feeling of loyalty to the institution. And so their column, their balance sheet, which says, well, maybe it's time to get out, starts to grow, and their balance sheet, which says, I should stay in, starts to shrink. So, again, I can certainly post it online. I think it's a very interesting read for anybody who's kind of interested in organizational psychology, because it really does cover what is occurring right now, and it kind of lays out this pathway for what you need to do for success, and that is you need to get back in front of the issue itself and start making these corrections now, because, yes, there are things you can do at the deck plate. I certainly plan to go out as an executive officer or a commanding officer in Japan, do everything I can to motivate and inspire men and women to remain in uniform, but at the end of the day, I can tell them the Navy is the greatest place to serve, but if they're not seeing that tangibly, and if they don't, and if I don't have the control to maneuver those big picture levers that affect their perception of quality of work or their perception of their quality of service, then there's probably actually very little I can do to keep them in.
And for those interested in that book who are up there on the chat room, I provided a link to that book. That's Albert O. Hirschman's book, Exit Voice and Loyalty, Response to Decline in Firms, Organizations, and States. If you're interested in looking at that, good link, Bus. One thing we love on the show, we love when people give book references, because I think that it's always good to see when somebody has an idea or a concept, what's helping to feed that in the background. So I appreciate the book recommendation. And Bus, I'd like for you, I want to direct the next question to Vice Admiral Moran, but I would like for you to weigh in and explain to the listeners why this made it into your recommendations. And you gave 14 recommendations in the paper. And I would be remiss if I didn't bring up number 9, because it's been a topic over the last 4 years of the show that comes up on a regular basis. And for those that have the paper with you, number 9, it talks about incentivize education opportunities within career paths. And Admiral Moran, the question I have is, you know, how do we build a survivable career path for our critical thinkers? You know, back in the mid-'80s, when I was a midshipman, on acetate on the overhead, that career path was put up. And here we are in the second decade of the 21st century, and besides the non-nuclear submarine career path, there really hasn't been all that much of a change. And we had on last week from the CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell, we had Commander Ben Salazar and a couple of the other guys that are in the CRIC on. And one subject that Lieutenant Ben Coleman brought up is a frustration on his part that we have people that we send on federal executive fellowship tours, postgraduate school, or even those that pursue doctorate degrees. And these are the type of people that are going to, we're not seeing them rewarded from a promotional point of view. And I guess inside your lifelines as a CNP, you've made some recent statements about the importance of critical thinking skills and how that reflects on some of what we want to do going forward. But has that been reflected in the precepts for screen and promotion boards? And in a larger sense, going back to leadership, when you look at our two degree-granting institutions, the officers we have running them, they don't even have advanced degrees themselves. And just within recent living memory, we had 4 flag officers with doctorates. We had Stavridis, Walsh, Sestak, and Pandolf. But when you look at the officers that are competitive for flag coming up behind them, we don't see that cohort coming on. Is this a temporary bubble, or have we changed the matrix on how we value higher education? And are you looking at, if we want the critical thinkers, if we want people with advanced education, how are we going to incentivize that and send the right messages to the fleet so that that really smart lieutenant commander has an opportunity to go get his PhD, but he goes, you know, the last 4 guys I saw do that, none of them screened for command, or, you know, 2/3 of them didn't. Are we looking at doing that, or are we still pretty much sticking with what we've been doing?
Yeah, so you're talking to a guy who got his master's at year 26 in his career from the National War College, how difficult it can be. And if you're if you look at the competition for what we have to do for a career progression, especially when the joint requirements in Goldwater Nichols are very restrictive, and they've gotten more and more restrictive over time, just to be eligible for commander and captain and flag, that law has made it it served its purpose, and we are probably the most joint force we have ever been by orders of magnitude, given the type of war the wars we've been fighting over the last 13 years. So I've asked the question of what things could we do to maybe begin to have a conversation with Congress about modifying the existing law to allow for the kinds of things you just raised. Because there's no question that it's difficult to have advanced education opportunities and stay on path to be a URL unrestricted line commanding officer somewhere and have the opportunity to promote. The unique examples that you used are unique. Those gents were incredible. They had incredible capacity and incredible desire, and that sometimes can overcome these obstacles that we've put in front of them. But for the vast majority of officers, it is very difficult to do, especially if you're trying to raise a family and you've got those demands. There's no question it's a challenge. So we are looking at it in terms of trying to structurally change what we do. The precept piece and the board piece actually has been discussed, and this week we have all the 3 and 4 stars in town and in the beginning of the week, and we're going to have a pretty good discussion from the 3-5 shop about building path to strategists, if you will. But if there's one thing I learned in the year I was fortunate enough to go to National War College here in town, was that critical thinking is part of everything we do. Every naval officer ought to have that background, and it does take some training. It does take some education. I was lucky. I got to do it in 2006. Unlucky in that it took me until 2006 to get to that point. I could have used that training and education a lot earlier in my career. But you've got to combine the training and the education with the experience that complements that training and education to build the types of folks you've described. And I think we can do it. CNO has certainly challenged us to figure out a way to do it, and we're in the early stages of addressing some of the issues you raised in that question.
Admiral, when we're looking at career paths, and part of the issue I've always discussed with junior officers seems to be the fitness report system and the ability of some people, I don't want to say to game it, but there is a certain way that some people always end up having more than one number one ranking person in a given cycle. How do we make the system evaluating our officers transparent and fair so that there isn't that feeling that there's a gaming going on?
Yeah, the gaming is pretty much we can ferret the gaming out pretty well. The folks down in Millington, when they see a discrepancy, I've seen it on a number of occasions over my career where COs have been called out by the folks down in Millington to correct the record, if you will. So I think that's less of a problem than you are inferring. Certainly, fitness reports can be improved. The way we do them can be improved. But I do believe it's about as fair as we're going to get, given as much as we've learned over the years. And I can assure you the last thing the fleet wants me to do is to change the fitness report system and the eval system again. So we have to do better with what we have. And having seen now how the Marines do it, the Army does it, the Air Force does it, everybody does it a little different in terms of the evaluation. And when we changed to the current fitness report that we have today, the notion was that the old one had gotten inflated and we needed to change it to reset. We have seen an inflation go on in the current system, and that has to be addressed. Otherwise, they become meaningless, and I think that's your point. Over.
Buzz, I wanted to bring up another topic here, because Admiral Moran, I mean this with the best love in the world, but Vice Admiral Moran and our senior leadership, they're baby boomers, second cohort baby boomers, but baby boomers nonetheless. Buzz, you and I and a lot of the post-command commanders that you write about and was kind of the genesis for this paper, they're Gen X. And when you read, a couple of times through your paper, a lot of the concern and the focus that I know you have and Admiral Moran has, it's the millennials, the junior officers. How do we create the conditions and the environment so when these men and women scream for Commander Command, that we have a different dynamic on their decision and we're able to keep the intellectual capital we want to keep. In the course of your research and discussions, Buzz, what are the critical differences that people need to keep in mind when they're thinking about incentives, goals, desires, and motivations when you go through that generational matrix from the baby boomer senior leadership to the Commander Command Gen X types to those millennials that you're trying to take actions to move the needle here in 10 to 15 years?
Well, Eagle, I think it's really two things. First is that, yes, generational differences do play into this equation. I don't necessarily know that they play into it as much as we might think, that there's some significant misalignment. I'm not sure that's the case. Do think, and the second part of this is that what really matters here is what the millennials, for example, feel is important to them or their cohorts. Maybe you even just drop the millennial tagline altogether and you just simply say, those men and women currently serving in uniform, whether they're officer or enlisted, who are in their first 5 to 10 years of time in the service, what is it that they find important? What is it that incentivizes them to want to remain in naval service? Because at the end of the day, I would submit that even though I produced this paper, it doesn't really matter what I personally think. And quite frankly, in some respects, I'm not sure that it matters what Vice Admiral Moran personally thinks. Because if you want to get ahead of this retention problem, what really matters from an organizational standpoint is what do they think? What is it that they find to be the most important? What will keep them in? And those are the levers that you need to reach out. And one, you need to understand the factors. And I believe the paper adequately covers those factors that are from our past, present, and future. And then secondly, kind of along lines with the 14 recommendations is, well, if you know what the factors are that are affecting their decision-making calculus, how do you now get in front of this? How do you, if money, as we know right now, is a significantly constrained resource, then what are the other things we can do to incentivize them to remain in uniform? And I would only caution that if the answer is, well, let's just continue to look for more signs of the problem, then we'll be once again reactive, vice proactive. And I think there are certainly things, and I think the paper highlights a few, where I would make the argument we do these to ourselves. I mean, they're decisions that are wholly owned by the men and women in the United States Navy. They do not require congressional oversight. And those are probably areas that we could go after first in order to, as you asked, help stop this retention problem that we see coming up.
Eagle One?
Trying to look over. One of the situations that it generally has been said that is that money is not a motivator after a certain point, but it can be a dissatisfier. But there are a lot of other issues that junior officers impacted by the delays in getting orders in a timely fashion written so they can take care of their families, having to deal with some of the PSDs and stuff. That's not really addressed in the paper, but it is one of those are factors that do affect retention. It's a lifestyle issue. Are there efforts being made to improve those types of issues? And if so, what are they?
Yeah, Eagle, it's a great point, and you're exactly right. I hear a lot more about those issues, and depending on where I go, than I do about the money side of things. And let me just say right up front that my job is, as cursed as it sounds, my job is to only spend as much money as I need to keep exactly the right number of people I need, not anymore. And, of course, you never achieve that perfect balance. You're either going to undershoot or overshoot the target, and we are trying our best not to undershoot it. But the issues you raised about just what I would describe as basic quality of work, quality of life kind of incentivizers are being addressed. But it starts in our world with this generation, going back to your discussion about millennials, is they're much more online, they're much more in an area where they expect to hit a button and be able to get answers quickly. And we're still living with, I would argue, maybe a 1950s, if at best 60s, IT infrastructure that doesn't allow us to do some of that. We're getting better. Some of our websites are actually starting to do things that millennials appreciate, but we still have a long way to go in that regard. Recently, the whole PSD Pass program came under N1's cognizance, and we've done some things there that are aimed at getting at making sure people are taken care of in a way that they expect. I will tell you that the last year again was miserable because when you're on a continuing resolution like we've been on for what the last at least three budget cycles. In the PCS world and the TDI world, that's the money you get to use to spend to send folks to school and training and route, is limited to quarter to quarter, so we can't write orders under those circumstances that extend beyond the quarter you're in. So it really limits our ability to get out in front of things, and that frustrates the hell out of young men and women who are trying to understand when they're going to move, where they're going to move, and how are they going to get the training they need and route. And we absolutely should take it on the chin over that, but it comes down to we've got to be allocated the money beyond just one quarter at a time in order to execute that money. So that, I mean, that's not to diminish the concern that young men and women have had over the last few years, and it's definitely had an impact, to Buss's point, about their perception and the trust in leadership to be able to deliver the kind of service they deserve when they put on a uniform. Over.
One thing that when you look through the paper and by side Moran, again, I like to kind of direct this your way and then Buss, you know, weigh in on the other side, is when you, everybody has their own perspective of things. The JO sees a problem from one angle, the mid-grade guy from another, the flag officer from another, civilian leadership, you know, they're all looking the same problem from different directions. And I think it's enlightening. For instance, you know, today you've mentioned a lot of things that your perspective as a vice admiral, it's just at the top of your head constantly because it has to be things like sequestration, the color of money. You know, that pops circuit breakers and sailors and junior officers' opinion because it's not in their circle of needing to be concerned with, though it is important. And one thing I've enjoyed doing is kind of trolling around a few places and looking at some of the response to the paper. And I was trying to, as best as I could, figure out, you know, what is the 03 to 05, when you look at those 14 points that are brought up in Buss's paper, that seem to come up. And it's interesting because we just talked about quality of life, quality about work, and some of this is kind of quality of command. And they involved refocus on removing some of the admin distractions, removing the examination requirement for unrestricted line command that's come up recently. There's a lot of discussions about, you know, originally I passed over looking at it, but I was surprised how many people really latched on to the idea of a milestone screen individual should be moved up to the front of their year group or a lineal number. And also rethinking how we do a lot of our mandatory annual training. As CMP, did any of those, when you first read the paper, really pop out at you as something that was really actionable? Or were there other items when you read through it, you went back and you went, hey, item X, Y, and Z, I hadn't really thought about that. That might be actionable. What were the sexy points that jumped out at you?
The conflict between the administrative burden we've added on to the plates of commanding officers and their ability to command is very much at the top of my agenda. And as you probably know, CNO Greenert assigned Admiral Richardson a 4-star to go look at how we can reduce that administrative burden because we all recognized CNO was getting this on just about practically every all hands call he had or focus group he had when he went around the fleet. I was seeing it and getting that feedback. Mick Pond was seeing it. So we knew we had a problem, so let's go solve it. And so we tried to do it in a way that connected with that millennial group, the younger men and women out there, by doing what we call a crowdsourcing event to try to find out where it took us, not trying to predetermine the outcome or think that we understood the answers, but try to get some ideas. And a lot of great ideas came of that. Some of it requires policy change. Some of it we can just write a NAV admin and eliminate it. I took it on early by taking on our general military training program, which laid on all kinds of requirements in very specific timelines and very specific points in time for COs in the fleet that had grown enormously over the last couple decades, and tried to free up some of that time by giving more flexibility to COs to determine what training they needed and when they needed it. Now, some of it is prescribed by law, some of it prescribed by OSD policy that they have to do, but the places where the Navy had control over it, the teams collectively between Admiral Richardson's work and the fleet commanders and their teams, we were able to trim down some of that stuff, so we had to take that on. And we're not nearly far enough. In fact, I read some of those blogs as well, and I think the one that got me chuckling just a little bit was that the RAD effort itself was an administrative distraction. So we obviously didn't get it right or at least as good as we could have. And so we're circling back on that. But I think to your real question is what was in that paper that I had not considered, we hadn't considered. The lineal number discussion certainly caught my eye and caught the eye of folks in this building, the one I'm sitting in, and said, man, that's interesting. I don't know we can do it, but everybody downstairs is burning some oil trying to figure out what it would look like, what it would mean, and then are there unintended consequences? We need to understand those so we don't make a mistake that really hurts sailors down the road. So that's probably the biggest one I saw. We are actively working, trying to lift the suspension on high deployments so that we can pay sailors for deployments in excess of 190 days. That suspension went in place right after 9/11. The Secretary of Defense put it out there, and so if we're out there for 9, 10 months or longer, we don't compensate sailors for that. And those are arduous deployments, as everybody who's done that before knows. So there are, you know, of all those 14 points, I'd say half of them we had been working on or have made some progress on. The other half, there's not a one that I've thrown out or we've thrown out as a bad idea. They're all ideas that we need and we are looking at to try to see if there's some there that we can apply in the near term as opposed to 2 or 3 years down the road. I hope that helps.
Bus, what were some of the interesting reactions that you've seen on your 14 points?
Well, like I mentioned, I think the fact that everyone seemed to be speaking with a similar voice caught my eye. Someone kind of described it to me this way, which I really appreciated, and that was in the big picture, they said the topic has resonated at the deck plate, and this came from a two-star. The topic has resonated at the deck plate, and what he had been hearing was that men and women want to stay in service, but kind of tongue-in-cheek, he said, but policies are risk driving them out. And so I thought that was kind of telling to me, because that kind of gets back to what you had started the last question which was the reduction of administrative burden or the zero defect mentality, those kinds of issues. Because just like Bessel Moranis correctly pointed out, this isn't just about money. It's about a lot of other factors, whether it's sustained high operational tempo for more than a decade. Because just like you mentioned, even though it has been largely a conflict fought over land, that doesn't mean that we're still not deploying it with high frequency and putting our ships out to sea and our men and women out to sea for long periods of time. So something that someone sent me, which I thought was very insightful, you mentioned you like references, so I'll throw this one out as well just because it kind of gives a different perspective, and that is it's by Colonel Mike Shaler. And so what it's titled is Junior Leader Retention. And this is a retired Army colonel who had spent 30 years in uniform in the Army, and he had worked, I believe, at the Doctrine Command as the director But he actually takes something that Ceno talks about all the time, which is quality of service. And I think Ceno sums it up that that's kind of the totality of what someone perceives about their time in uniform. And it's a two-part equation. It's either going to be it's affected by your quality of work. Are you getting the money you need? Are you getting the tools and the training and the skill sets you need? Are you happy with your job? And the second part is your quality of life. Are you well compensated? Are you receiving some of the benefits that make a difference to you and to your family? But the paper by Colonel Mike Shaler actually draws out a third one, and that is quality of leadership. And once again, I don't think it's intended to point the finger uphill and say, okay, well, let's assess our senior leaders. I don't think that's the point. What the point is that that's what junior officers are doing, and those are the ones that we're certainly worried about keeping in for the long haul if we want to keep quality in service. And so, you know, it's one of those things where I'd almost admit you kind of expand the equation by one. You say, okay, well, your time in uniform, your quality of service, how you perceive that is a combination of the type of work you do, your quality of work, your quality of life for you and your family, and the quality of leadership that you perceive around you. And that's where I think we can really truly make some substantial inroads with some of the recommendations. And quite frankly, I know we keep kind of hinging on the 14 recommendations. You know, I'm glad that people seem to feel that some of them have resonated with them, but I think there are probably a lot more better ones that are out there. These were designed solely for Vice Admiral Moran to kind of give him something maybe to bounce around his staff and to work on. It wasn't necessarily meant for public dissemination. So in some cases, they may be perceived as very limited in scale. But some of these things that Vice Admiral Moran mentioned, like the reduction of administrative distractions, the just inordinate amount of online training, a lot of the distractors that we have put in place, I think that kind of could be bend into that third category of quality of leadership. So if we expand the equation a little bit, maybe that gives us some additional areas that we can tackle that will once again incentivize men and women to want to remain in uniform for the long haul.
Well, Admiral and Bus, we have managed to take up an hour of your time, and it seemed like about 10 minutes to me, so I really enjoyed the conversation. I will add that I'm old enough that I remember the Zumwalt days, and some of these battles to drive out Mickey Mouse or whatever you want to call it, we fought a few decades ago, and it's nice to see that they're back, and it's nice to see that some of the things have caught the attention of people in high places, and it looks like you're going to make progress on them. So, gentlemen, from my side, thank you very much for coming on with us, and I'm sure Sal has some final words for you, too.
Yeah, I sure do, Vice Admiral Moran, and Bus, I'd really like to thank for the opportunity for you all to come on here. And again, kind of what we started off with, BZ to everybody is a fact. You've kind of leaned into it. You're out here. You're in the discussion. And I know the shoes over at Sailor Bob have even let you come play around there, Bus. And I really think a lot of people agree or disagree have really appreciated the fact that we as an institution, are willing to engage in a marketplace of ideas, because I think everybody here is focused on the same thing, is to make sure our Navy is best and has the intellectual capital part of that to be best. So thanks again for taking time this afternoon specifically to be with us, but also for what you're doing to get the conversation going, so hopefully we can all get better and closer to where we need to be.
Thanks, Al. Well said, and I really appreciate the opportunity to get out here, and I ask you to keep us honest, and if there's an opportunity down the road to do this again when we've got a little something to follow up on, I'd be happy to do that. Thank you.
Yes, sir.
And
we'd love
Sal,
to do
Eagle
it.
Eye, thanks again for the I was just going to say to both of you, thanks again. Admiral, thank you for your time, and thanks for letting me be a part of this discussion, which, quite frankly, you're much more well-equipped to handle than me. And Eagle Eye, you brought it up, so I'm going to close it out this way. You mentioned Admiral Zumwalt, and I think your viewers or your listeners would find it interesting that the very second Z-gram he sent out was to establish the retention study group. So just like you pointed out, these do come in waves. So if anybody's interested, you can check out Z-gram number 2, and it'll walk you through it.
That's our third reference for the day, and once again, I appreciate everybody who's joined us here for the show, especially with our guests. Vice Admiral Bill Moran, Chief of Naval Personnel, and Commander Bus Snodgrass. Thank you very much. Hope everybody has a great Navy day, and we'll see you next week for another edition of MidRats. Cheers.
Maloney. silly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same.
It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go. It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
Goodbye, Piccadilly.